Welcome back to another episode of City Hall Pass. I'm Kapel Lungani, counsel to the mayor of New York City. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to give you, the public, a unique window into the highest levels of our city government. We interview New York City's finest public servants and get them to open up in a way that is both deeply personal and insightful. And on its best days, we hope that our podcast is equal parts educational and inspiring. And now I want to introduce my two co-hosts today, two brilliant women who inspire me every day, Bess Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Bess Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce our guest today, the legendary Manhattan District Attorney, Cy Vance. Cy began his professional journey by taking a job as an assistant district attorney with the Manhattan DA's office back in the 1980s. After spending some time on the West Coast, Cy felt a calling to come back home. And after a few years in private practice in New York City, he was elected as Manhattan DA and was sworn in on January 1st, 2010. In the last decade, the Manhattan DA's office has become a national leader in criminal justice. Under Cy's leadership, it is also a place that lawyers from across the country dream about landing a job, including yours truly. Cy's achievements are far too lengthy to summarize. Suffice it to say that his work has made this city safer. For example, as a result of his office's work, thousands of illegal firearms from our streets have been seized and violent gang members have been held accountable. Cy also created the first conviction integrity program and crime strategies unit in the five boroughs and reduced unnecessary incarceration and the prosecution of low-level nonviolent offenses. In this episode, Cy candidly talks about his unique personal and professional journey. From watching his father, the former Secretary of State under President Carter, resolve weighty issues of diplomacy, to Cy's efforts to transform the DA's office into a national leader in racial justice and reform, Cy gives us a unique window into the life of one of New York's great public servants. We hope you enjoy. And now I want to welcome the Manhattan District Attorney to City Hall Pass, Cy Vance. Cy was first sworn in as District Attorney of New York County on January 1st, 2010. And since then, he's enhanced the District Attorney's Office as a national leader in criminal justice by expanding its expertise on an array of 21st century crimes. He's also been a figure that many of us have encountered in our professional lives. And there are very few people in the city who I respect more than Cy Vance. So without further ado, I want to welcome the Manhattan DA to City Hall Pass. Cy, I want to start by talking a little bit about your background. I think your background is rich in public service. Your father served as Secretary of the Army under Presidents John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson, and Deputy Secretary of Defense under President Johnson, and then finally as Secretary of State to President Jimmy Carter. How did your father's service inspire you?
It was clear to me growing up in our house where my father was in and out of public service from my earliest memories, that working in the public service capacity was work he loved. He was extremely good at it. And I think those things that made him good are those things that make any employee good. He was very hardworking. He was totally trustworthy. And people who worked with him could rely on him in the most difficult situations. He was intimately involved in the peace accords at Camp David. And I think that whole experience showed that his ability to bring people together and to, because of his own directness and honesty, was obvious. And as a child, I saw all that and I picked up on all that. And I saw the pleasure that government service work gave to him, as hard as it was for him. And so it was, well, I flirted with taking other avenues professionally. Once I got out of college, I worked for a shipping company in Africa for on and off for 4 or 5 years. Ultimately, I came full circle and went to law school and have been practicing law ever since.
Obviously, your father dealt with a lot of powerful people during his career. You, as the Manhattan DA, also deal with a lot of powerful people, and you are one of the most powerful and respected people in your profession. What lessons, if any, did he teach you about how to handle power?
My mother was a much better read than my father on powerful personalities. I'm not sure he could see those folks who had it out for him as well as my mother could. And so watching my mother, whose antennae on powerful people who meant him ill will, was much more attuned. So that was a good balance. Yes, it was an exciting life for them, and they were in the middle of a lot of interesting people and places and jobs. But my mother was never too impressed with anybody who presented themselves as, you know, as powerful. And I think it's always an important lesson not to let power get to your head.
Who's the most interesting person your father brought home for dinner?
Many interesting folks came through our house, from Jimmy Carter to Kofi Annan, Robert McNamara. A generation passed. It was a fascinating era, particularly when I was younger, living in Washington, D.C., during the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. They're sort of great historical figures, perhaps because it's 50 years ago, they seem great and historical. But I think the most interesting, it was not who came to our house, but as a young child, I spent the night in the White House with Lyndon Johnson, called me in. I thought he was a larger-than-life character. And in person, was just like he's described in the books. Big, booming, and as a young boy, sort of intimidating, but not threatening.
So we're all lawyers in this room. But for our listeners out there who are not, and who have maybe only experienced lawyers, particularly prosecutors, through popular television shows like Law & Order, can you tell us what the Manhattan DA's office does?
First and foremost, as in most states, the district attorney is an elected job. In New York State, it is an elected through a political party system. And so I ran for district attorney as a Democrat in 2009. And I run an office of about 1,500 people, about 600 lawyers roughly, and the rest professional staff. The most straightforward description is our lawyers who go into court to take criminal cases that have been filed and to prosecute those cases. Prosecuting a case doesn't necessarily mean every case goes to trial. In fact, most cases come into the office by way of a police arrest. The case is analyzed, and 95% of the 100% end up being resolved without a trial. And so a lot of the work is done analyzing cases, the decision-making about whether to bring a case, what charges to bring in a case. The job has changed significantly in my last 10 years in the sense that because of our white-collar prosecutions and forfeiture we've obtained in those prosecutions over the years, some $14 billion all told, working with federal partners, we have actually been a major funder. I sort of like acting like a foundation, having set up a process within our office and outside our office through expert guidance from CUNY, state and local government institution. We have essentially been making grants both to city agencies like the police, NYCHA, we'll talk more about that, as well as a $250 million project that we call the Criminal Justice Investment Initiative, which is essentially identifying areas in our communities, particularly Manhattan, whether it is dealing with families that are justice involved in some way, or victims, or reentering citizens coming back from prison, about 50 or 53 different grants totaling hundreds of millions of dollars to these organizations, trying to get money to the grassroots organizations in the communities of Manhattan who desperately need it and who often don't have the managerial experience like United Way or major not-for-profits, but trying to identify excellence at the ground level and then support it.
Can you talk a little bit about how you and your office came up with the idea for the Criminal Justice Investment Initiative?
First and foremost, I went into the office, and I think district attorneys around the country today have shifted appropriately their thinking about how to do their job. A DA's office always has to, strive for excellence in lawyering and in investigations and aggressively rooting out business crime and corruption and dealing with violence from the streets. But I think more and more I came to understand that crime prevention strategies, strategies that are designed to, by supporting communities or individuals who are particularly vulnerable, such as folks coming back from prison, that prevention strategies that support those individuals in a way that seeks to prevent them from offending is just as important a crime fighting strategy as processing an arrest or doing a white-collar investigation. So, for example, in New York State, we support funding for college and prison in New York State prison facilities. And there's about 14 facilities that now offer college education in prison. And the point of that is I know that if a man or woman gets a college degree in prison, that individual is going to have next to a zero chance of getting back in trouble when they get out. I mean, just statistically, it is an investment. You're preventing future costs and future painful experiences, and you are also giving that person who's going to college the tools to succeed. It's a crime prevention strategy. So the job changed because I was spending a lot of time focusing on prevention. We funded and then staffed up and implemented a national rape kit backlog effort, which lasted over 5 years and resulted in 60,000, 70,000 rape kits that have been sitting on shelves themselves in distant states, untested for all these years, which was an abomination. Whenever I leave this office, I think I will have had just a phenomenal experience and opportunity, both doing the cases, which I love, I'm a lawyer and love the role of courts and being in court, but realizing that we've had the privilege to do some amazing work because we've been so independent financially.
What was your vision on day one when you walked into the DA's office?
When I ran for DA, I had put together a briefing book for interviews with New York Times and other folks. And we had about 20 things that we wanted to do. And I was pleased to say that we'd done them all, except for one, I haven't learned Spanish. But they were as sort of straightforward as build a cyber lab. And I knew, having come out of private practice, and I've spent a lot of time on the West Coast and the Northwest, I mean, I understood that cyber was going to be our biggest challenge. And I think it is. I think it is the biggest threat because it also crosses economic crime, terrorism, drug operation. It's integral to all those. And so we're going to build a cyber lab. And ultimately, 5 or 6 years in, we worked with the city council and we funded half, they funded half to build a cyber lab in a unit that I think is second to none in the country. We have 75 folks, a very sophisticated lab. And so there's the vision. I had some concrete things I was going to do. I was going to open an office in Washington Heights. You know, I was running in the era of stop and frisk. And so I brought in the Vera Institute of Justice to do essentially a racial bias analysis of our charging, our bail decisions, our sentence recommendations, which took about 2 or 3 years. Again, that was something that I knew, one of the things I wanted to do. It was clear to me that the knowledge that we gained through the Vera study was valuable. When I was a young lawyer in this office in the 80s, I'd walk into courts and 95% of the individuals in court were men and women of color. I come back to run the office 35 years later. It's exactly the same picture. Exactly. And how is it possible that after 35 years, you essentially are coming into a courtroom that looks just the same as it did when you left? I think there's two ways you address that. One is the way that the federal government, the state government, and city government can address issues of disparity, racial and economic, through big picture policies, you know, education, employment, housing, the things that deliver on the promise of equal opportunity for American families. That was beyond my ability. But what I could do is I could be much more thoughtful and intelligent about who I'm bringing into the justice system and try to radically reduce safely the number of men and women, 95% of whom are going to be women, men and women of color. And in that way, change the trajectory, hopefully, of those individuals' lives who didn't come into the system but had some other off-ramp. That way, reduce the footprint of our system to use only on cases that I thought needed to come into the system. So in 2010, we had 110,000 cases or 100,000 cases. Last year, we prosecuted 49,000. And the biggest reduction was not in violent crime, because we've always been, I think, appropriately tough and rigorous working on violent crime. But, you know, we changed the policy. We weren't going to prosecute marijuana. We changed the policy. We weren't going to prosecute fare evasion. Those were the two largest arrest categories in Manhattan anyway. Overwhelmingly, the people arrested were men and women of color, and nothing happened in the court system when they came in and those cases were processed. The court system was not designed or capable of intervening in their lives and making things better. You know, they just came in and the case was processed, and it was another negative notch on their record for cases that really I felt were disproportionately punitive for the nature of the crime itself.
I want to talk a little bit about your relationship with the NYPD. When you were thinking through this issue that you just spoke about, namely ending the routine prosecution of low-level crimes like marijuana, you know, jumping over turnstiles, loitering, what was the reaction of NYPD?
First and foremost, let me say I have really felt lucky and privileged to have worked alongside and sometimes in opposition to Ray Kelly, Bill Bratton, Jimmy O'Neill, and now Dermot Shea. You know, these are interesting and I think hugely well-intentioned public servants who care deeply about their mission. The motives were always to make New York safer. So the relationship with each commissioner changed. Bill Bratton was enormously collaborative. That is his nature. He doesn't look at us as trying to, it's not a zero-sum game for him, that if we do something, it's taking something away from him. Truly collaborative. And that was the era when we were making significant investments, $100 million to NYCHA, $100 million to the NYPD, in order to support their efforts to drive crime low. And Jimmy and Bill and many police officers were very sensitive and are very sensitive to the concept. The subways are like the arterial system of the city. And if you lose the subways, you know, you're going to lose the city. And so those conversations were over time. And yet I think looking at the numbers, that ultimately the decisions to find alternatives such as summonses to criminal prosecutions of certain of these low-level misdemeanors, I think we showed that you can, in fact, do both, and it's not an either or. But I think one change that's happened in prosecution around the country is that prosecutors are understanding sort of their responsibilities and the nature of their power, and that we actually have a lot of authority in the criminal justice system. And I think that what I like to tell those who disagree with me is, if they disagree with me on a certain policy, that's not my job. You know, I have a different job and I have a different agency. And if I don't want to spend $3,000 in man hours on a theft of service case, when I know when it gets to court, nothing is going to happen. I'd rather take that 20 hours of work and focus on gang activity or focus on something else.
I grew up in New York. I'm a child of the 80s. I love New York, past, present, future. 1980s New York was very different than present day New York. Homicides were at a record high. There was a crack epidemic. But that's really where you started your legal career, at the Manhattan DA's office in the 1980s. What was it like working in the DA's office at the time?
It is ironic that when the city is at its worst, sometimes that's when the cases and the challenge are the most interesting. And I will say that working in the 80s, it was like a boat with five holes on the bottom, and you're just trying to empty the buckets of water to keep it afloat, but it's always kind of sinking. First of all, I think the office itself, we changed a lot. We changed a lot in policies and stuff that has changed our fabric. But fundamentally, I think the ethos of the office was principally the same. We had Bob Morgenthau, who was the DA, who was well-respected. And I think the ethical foundation of the office was sound. And I think that's one thing I believe our office has, which is a treasure. If you lose that, it's hard to recover. So I thought the office was grounded in the right way, but it was totally chaotic and just a madhouse in terms of the volume of cases. And the courts were overwhelmed. And all I can say is it bonfire of the vanities. It was not far off. And yet it was a very exciting time to work in the office.
Was that, professionally speaking, the most satisfying time in your life?
I think many say who leave the Manhattan DA's office that time working as an assistant DA is the most rewarding professional experience of their lives. And it was for me. And so when I left and went out to the West Coast, I always had it in my mind that I would like to be the Manhattan DA someday. But I will say that when I went out to the West Coast, and I had a very interesting law practice with great partners, and Seattle was going through huge changes at the time, I don't think I ever would have been Manhattan DA had I not left New York and, you know, gained experiences that I did in a different culture and as a defense lawyer. I think I gained an awful lot that enabled me, when I came back, entered into private practice, to be much more clear about what I thought we should be doing in the office on day one.
What ultimately convinced you to run?
Well, my wife had wanted to come back to New York City for a long time. She's got very strong family roots here family I love. And ultimately, it was time. In the Northwest analogy, you know, it's like a salmon. You go out, and you go out wherever the hell you go out as an adventure. But at some point, something clicks in your brain, and the salmon turns around and goes home because it realizes it's time to go home. And that is much like, I think, what happened to us. I ran for DA because, number one, I love the work, I love the office, and because I felt I could be a really effective leader for the office, and I loved the idea of working for public service in this office. And I've always had this in the back of my mind: if I don't try, I'll never know.
You know, I was an assistant U.S. attorney, and I remember talking to the U.S. attorney in D.C. who hired me, and he said, you know, hiring is one of my great legacies. Could you talk about your approach to hiring and what you look for when you bring on people into what I think everyone across this country would say is the most elite district attorney's office in the country?
We hire about 50 to 65 people a year, economic crises depending. And when I speak with them, I've met them all. First of all, I offer each person the job. I tell them that what I'm asking them to do is, you know, some very simple things to be successful in this office, to be successful as a prosecutor. They're all smart enough, so that's not the issue. It's that they have to work hard, they have to work as a team, and they have to be humble and have a sense of humility about the power that they're exercising and the ability to understand that when you think you're right, in fact, you may not be. And I give them, you know, an example of a case that I had as a young prosecutor when I had a man indicted for shotgun robberies in the Greenwich Village area. And I had probably 30 or 40 eyewitnesses to 10 or 15 incidents. And I would have sworn on Bible that there was no question this was the guy. But about 2 weeks into the case, it turned out it wasn't the guy. You know, that has always stuck with me, that, you know, you can be absolutely convinced that you're right, but the power that we have requires us to be humble and recognize, and they should recognize, they need to use their power very carefully.
Hey there, and thanks for listening to City Hall Pass. We'll be right back with more from our conversation with Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance. But I want to take a second to remind our listeners to get tested for COVID-19. And remember, tests are free and confidential. Text COVID-TEST to 85548 or visit nyc.gov/COVID-TEST to find a convenient site near you. I also want to remind our listeners that there's a new COVID-19 hotline. Call for free advice from medical staff, quarantine guidance, emergency food, hotel rooms, mental health counseling, and much more. Call 212-COVID-19 from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 7 days a week. Back to you, Bess.
2020 has been extremely challenging for all New Yorkers. We've all had to adapt in different ways, you know, big and small. And the courts and the criminal justice system itself has been deeply challenged. How has the COVID pandemic affected you professionally, and how has it affected you personally?
Personally, we have been very blessed to have our family thus far unaffected. And what can you say, except for that's just, it's a blessing, it's remarkable. You know, the tragedy that COVID has brought to New York City and to the country, there's just, I think we all feel it. I think it's been an enormous weight on all of us, understandably. It will change all of us because of some of the lessons we've learned from COVID about how we work, the importance of family, about the importance of taking care of ourselves, and about, as in criminal justice, the much greater impact on communities of color. As to the system, there's no way to overstate it, frankly. We have 5,000 backlogged felony complaints that need to be indicted, and there are no grand juries, and there are no trials. So it just keeps backing up. We have 8 or 9 grand juries in regular times to handle the volume of cases. When you add 5,000 cases on top of that, how are we going to dig out of that? We're going to have to think way outside the box on how to deal with this backlog.
We've only touched the surface of the extraordinary achievements of your office over the last 10 plus years. In fact, you recently established an Equity and Social Justice Advisory Board within your office in order to give people of color a greater policy voice. When you look back upon these last 10 plus years, what accomplishment in particular are you most proud of?
Well, I'd start with cases, as any lawyer would. There are many, but ones that, you know, where I became deeply involved were finding out who killed Eitan Peetz, a murder that happened in 1979 and that has still a wound that had never been healed. That was to make the decision to reopen that case, identify the killer. You know, that's a case that just was very emotional for me. Prosecuting Harvey Weinstein, ultimately, successfully, it was also a case that was extraordinarily difficult. And there's another case that I will remember. I think the Criminal Justice Investment Initiative was something that being able to invest $1 billion. On top of that, give $3 billion to the state and $500 million to the city. On top of that, I just would have never expected our office to be such a net giver. And I'm so happy that we were. We do want to help the city. You know, we've committed $100 million to stand up the supervised release for New York City, because when the laws changed discovery statewide and set up, you know, a pretrial service system, but didn't fund it. So these things, I just didn't expect that we'd do it. But I surrounded myself with really smart people. We sort of had a vision of where we wanted investments to go, guided by professionals. And I think at the end of the day, you know, that's something that I don't know any other office having the privilege to do.
So towards the end of the administration, I've been thinking more and more about what advice I would have given myself on day one. And I think I would have told myself, talk to as many people as possible, especially working closely with so many agencies and teams. You really get to know the individuals, and they always have answers to your really unique questions, like, what do you do if a whale washes up on the beach? Or can I hang this flag from a city flagpole? Or what if an earthquake hits the city? Like, what are we doing to mitigate that risk? If you could give yourself some advice on day one in your office, what would it be?
I would go back to the issue around race and criminal justice. I went in, I thought, taking unusual steps, very unusual for prosecutor's office, to do what we did with Vera. But I could have and should have done more in the intervening years around recognizing that the office could be doing a better job in making sure that those men and women, lawyers and professional staff who came into our office and were of color, to ensure as best as I could that they had the same opportunities, to make sure that their professional experience was as supported as anyone else in the office. So this Social Equity Advisory Board, the teams that were talking to me, really wanted a way to be able to propose policy at a sophisticated level to the DA and to have their hand on the steering wheel, so to speak. I thought it was a great idea. And so they now have had four or five sort of dense policy proposals, which they've talked to me about and they've walked through with me, and they've done a very good job researching. And going forward, of course, the office won't succeed in continuing its reputation unless it attracts the best lawyers from all backgrounds. And so it's an imperative for the business to succeed in the future. And that's why it's so important. And that's why I look at, the time, my time in the office remaining. I really want to make sure that it is now embedded, permanent, and we can build on this.
Okay, so I'm going to introduce a new game I call Pick a Side. We will give you a choice of two words, and you have to tell us which one is relevant. It's a stretch. So for example, do you like coffee or tea? I would choose tea. I prefer tea. So ready?
Yeah.
Okay. DC or NYC?
NYC.
Car or motorcycle?
Motorcycle.
Photographer or podcast host?
Photographer.
West Coast or East Coast?
East Coast, but the West Coast is great.
Okay. Law and Order or Blue Bloods?
Law and Order.
Puppies behind bars or kittens in the clink?
Puppies, absolutely.
And do you want to say a little bit about why you choose puppies?
Sure. My wife, Peggy, who is a photographer, among other things, has been working with Puppies Behind Bars for maybe 7 or 8 years now. And Gloria Gilbert Stoga is this wonderful woman who started Puppies Behind Bars after 9/11 as a way of trying to figure out how she could help men and women returning from Afghanistan and Iraq who had physical disabilities or psychological disabilities by giving them service dogs, which are trained, as incredibly trained as these dogs are, to help these men and women in their daily lives. The dogs are trained by prisoners in upstate facilities who go to actually live in a separate unit with their puppies under their bed or with them 24/7. And the puppy comes in and the prisoners are trained, the men and women are trained on how to train the dogs. Then there's a graduation, usually 5 or 6 veterans, now with their own puppy. I also got to say, for me, being in the prisons and getting to speak to, and in some cases know over time, the men and women in prison and in these programs has also been phenomenally important and impactful to me. We actually then had our assistants go up to the prison to see how this was done. And we decided that we would actually have a program where we would send prosecutors from our office into a prison facility on a weekly basis for 3 to 6 months. They would take a 6-month course together and reads the same books and have essentially a curriculum. The assistants who've gone through that, we've had now 5 or 6 or 7 graduations. And these guys are folks who are about, 6 months about to come out. But for the assistants in our office, again, that has been career changing and life changing. They're coming out of that saying, I did not imagine how close I could be and how much I had in common with these guys and women that were in prison. And so these are things that, this, I think it's an important step. We have to do a better job in dealing with men and women that we send to prison. I think if you visit prisons around the state, you would come out and say, we have to do better than this.
Sai, thank you for joining us today. Your name is synonymous with justice and excellence in New York City. On behalf of people here in City Hall and the millions of New Yorkers who benefited from your exceptional service over the last 10 plus years, thank you. And thank you for taking time out of your day to join us.
Well, it has been my great pleasure. It's the best part of my day, I guarantee it. Thank you, guys. That's lots of fun.
I want to thank the Manhattan District Attorney, Sai Vance, for spending time with us today. Sai truly is a legend, and our city is safer because of his work and devotion to New York City. And thanks to you, as always, for taking the time to listen, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Take care, everyone.
This podcast is brought to you by the Office of the Counsel to the Mayor of New York City.